From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, our Challenges Ahead special. Today, we'll take a look at three challenges, some closer at hand, others further out, that American agriculture will be facing in the future. We'll explore the expansion of agriculture overseas, particularly in Brazil, what a mega drought in the western United States might mean to agriculture in the Midwest, and how weed control is becoming more of a problem over time. We'll do all of that right here on this edition of the Closing Market Report. It comes to you from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
We'll start our challenges with overseas competition, particularly from Brazil. Earlier this year in the fall, the FarmDoc team put together a series of webinars, one of them focused on the United States versus Brazil. Joanna Colucci, who's a PhD student in ag econ here on campus, and agricultural economist Gary Schnittke discussed Brazil and how it's been competing with the United States on the world export market for soybeans for the last couple of decades, and the last few years has become a major corn exporter. Here are some excerpts from that webinar, which, by the way, you can find on the FarmDoc Daily website. I'll tell you how when we finish up. We'll begin with Joanna Colucci, who laid out the basics of agriculture in Brazil.
Brazil has around 70 million hectares of degraded pastures and grasslands. That is one area the size of the Texas state. All that available land makes for a great alternative for expanding the country's agriculture without deforestation. That's very important. This is one of the biggest competitive advantages that Brazil has over its traditional competitors.
Joanna, by the way, is a native of Brazil, and Portuguese is her first language. She just told us about the number of acres, hectares, 70 million, about the size of Texas, that's yet available to come into production, and that this is all pasture land, not land that needs to be deforested.
It is important to highlight that Brazil uses only 30% of its territory for agriculture and livestock, and keeps 66% of its native vegetation. On this map, you can see the land use and occupation. For example, Brazil uses only 90% of its territory as croplands. This 90% includes all sugarcane, grains, planted forest, and fruit production, for example.
Brazil is the fifth largest country on the planet in terms of total area. Of that total area, it uses about 30% for all agricultural production. And of the total area, only 9% is dedicated to grains and oilseed production, including soybeans, by the way, which they raised 5.2 billion bushels worth of this past year. It was a big crop, bigger than what the United States raised, and it was a short crop by Brazil standards. Still, Brazil averaged some 52 bushels to the acre. That's about the same as the United States. And Gary Schnittke says there are three factors that have been driving the Brazilian soybean market. Those are international prices, port premiums, and the exchange rate. And these factors are likely to continue over time, and Brazil will continue to become a larger part of the export market. They're number one already.
Brazil is expected to increase both in terms of its exports. So Chinese demand, like here, remains strong in Brazil. But it's also, some of this is also going to the crush, which is the biodiesel part of it, and also the meat industry. Brazil is exporting more meat, again, primarily to China, and that growth in the livestock sector is impacting impacting what we expect to see in China, or excuse me, in Brazil, in terms of soybean production.
When Gary Schnittke there said both, he meant both corn and soybeans. Over the last couple of years, in fact, Brazil has played a major role in the corn export market. Joanna Colucci outlines how.
Brazil's share of the world corn trade increased from 7.5% in 2011 to 22% in 2021. In the USDA's agriculture project to 2030, Brazil is expected to be the world's second largest corn exporter over the next 10 years. Behind the US, of course, but ahead to Argentina and Ukraine.
So from 2011 to 2021, Brazil's corn exports increased from 7.5% to 22% of the world export market, and followed, of course, behind the United States. The question then is this big enough, or will it be big enough to impact the US corn export market in the future? Gary Schnittke has some thoughts.
Here's what we're expecting Brazilian grain acreage projections to do, and this is just acreage, so 40% increase in the next decade. So we're expected to see that acreage in grain production increased by 40%. This is the reason why, if you're looking at high corn and soybean prices now, you might want to temper your expectations in the future, because there's 40% new acres coming on in Brazil, and there likely will be other acres as well. And again, those acreage increases are coming in those new areas. At the same time that we see a 40% acreage increase, we expect grain production to increase 1%. The 71% is higher than that acreage increase because of several factors. One of those is yield increases, so building in those usual yield increases. And that would be impacting the United States as well as Brazil. We'd be building in yield increases. But also the other part of that is contributing to that 71% increase is the double crop and triple crop phenomena, corn being safrinha corn and third crop corn, obviously doubling up on those acres, and that would then increase acreage total crop production. Continue to expect soybean exports and corn exports, and also meat exports to grow from Brazil. Again, you're looking at those areas in growth, and therefore you would expect the Brazilian exports to increase in exports. Again, if you're making a comparison between the U.S. and Brazil, U.S. has relatively stable grain acreage. We've probably done about as much double cropping. Maybe we can do double cropping around here to a certain extent with wheat and soybeans, but the double crop and triple crop phenomena is likely to be much larger in Brazil than here, and that will contribute to that acreage increase and therefore exports as well. As long as we have profitable corn and soybean production, you will expect to see those acres to grow in Brazil. The other point of that is that in terms of operating cost, or you know, if you look at non-land cost, the cost in Brazil and U.S. are relatively equal to one another. Where Brazil has a big advantage is in land cost, and because they have that supply of land, they will have lower land cost. And also, as the infrastructure improves, that will get factored in here as well.
Just a point of clarification, Gary Schnittke and Joanna Colucci expect that Brazil's cropping area will increase by 40% in the future. That's for all crops, and that yield will increase by some 71%. If you'd like to learn more about Brazilian agriculture as it compares to the United States, you can look for the FarmDoc Daily webinar at the FarmDoc Daily website. Look for webinars, and then the archive. We'll turn our attention now from the global stage and competition from overseas to things that are happening here in the United States. Last summer, the USDA hosted a webinar on a potential mega drought that may be developing in the western United States and how it might impact agriculture across the whole of the nation. USDA's chief meteorologist set the stage for the discussion by outlining centuries worth of droughts that have had an impact on the area in the western United States. And much of that work was gathered from tree rings, and USDA highlighted what it called mega droughts that lasted decades rather than months or even a couple of years. It proposes the West, now in the midst of a drought, if it continues, could be in a mega drought. Here we'll focus on short-term rather than long-term ramifications, as explained by USDA Chief Economist Seth Meyer. He started by pointing to some direct impacts of the drought this past growing season.
A bad spring wheat crop and a bad durum crop because of drought. Those tend to go into things like hitting our export markets for white wheat for noodles in Asia or pasta. And so I think we see lots of short-run effects. But I think when we talk about a mega drought, I want to get into some of these longer effects as well, too. And even in the short market dynamics, one of the things I'd show was a larger cow slaughter because the lands in the West simply won't perhaps hold as many cow-calf pairs on those pasture. And we have pasture conditions that are both mixed and really terrible.
We'll focus right there on the beef cattle herd in the Western Plains. Clearly, there's a forage shortage. Pastures have dried up and hayfields, actually the nation's number one cash crop, have also suffered from dry conditions. There are short and medium run issues that back up into the corn and soybean fields of the Midwest because of this.
Even if we were to break out of this drought, there are lingering effects. And I'll go back to the fact that producers of cattle in the West have the choice of either really poor forage conditions and low handling numbers, you know, density for cow-calf pairs, or sending those animals off to feed on what is right now very expensive corn and, for other animals, soybeans.
Now hold that in mind. Interestingly, on July 22nd, the chief economist at the United States Department of Agriculture said he did not think the current high price of corn and soybeans was exactly a supply issue.
Some of it is maybe a little bit smaller corn and bean crops than we might have anticipated. I think it's robust domestic and foreign demand in particular. And when we look at inflation of food products, it really is on those meat animal sides where, again, demand has been really robust. So far, in big aggregates, I would say the drought is not a driver or not the principal driver. But that may very well change. When we think about beef prices and beef price impacts going forward, Western drought, cow slaughter, that's meat. Those cows being slaughtered, which may be a little bit of excess cow slaughter today, is a steak in 2024.
That's a missing beef steak that won't be there in 2024. Possible food inflation, and a feed grain market at stake because that animal won't be in the finishing lot eating corn.
And that's where we end up with this potential condition that, you know, if we have a problem with cows, those cows need to move to other locations or be slaughtered. And again, this affects our ability to produce beef because of biological lags years out.
Well, there are many points to the discussion Seth Meyer had with the employees of USDA as it's related to the drought in the western United States. Certainly, one is that it backs into other parts of the nation. The other is that if it is truly a climate-changing mega-drought with a decades-long duration, the economic disruption could be very deep. We'll stay with the weather for our last agricultural challenge moving forward. This also came from the Fall FarmDoc Daily webinar series, which you can find at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu in the archives section. Again, in this webinar, we talked about weeds and the variability of the weather going forward as the climate has been changing over the last 50 years and what that means for weed suppression. Aaron Hager was there along with Marty Williams. I did ask Aaron before we started the program to talk a little bit about the weed problems that producers saw in their fields this year and what he thinks is of enough concern to consider as it relates to the 2022 growing season.
We had several significant issues come up this year, Todd, without a doubt. And so certainly encourage folks to, you know, make note of what they see, how to address it perhaps better going into the next growing season. And, you know, meet with somebody, give us a call, and we'll be happy to have a conversation, see if we can perhaps come up with some better recommendations for the next growing season.
What kind of particular problems do you think they'll see?
I think we're going to have some issues next year, especially on the supply chain side. We've had conversation with several distributors and primary manufacturers, and there's probably going to be quite a bit of tight inventory next year. So we'll have to give some thought about, you know, application rates, timings, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, trying to make sure that we can get through most of the growing season to adequately maintain the weed management in order to try to maximize crop yield in 2022.
Do you mean to say that scouting fields next season will be imperative so that you can time applications properly and use only what you need to?
Yeah, next year could be very, very critical, as you mentioned, for the appropriate timing, because if we're late, we may not have that rescue treatment available next year.
Are there any new active ingredients in the pipeline over the next several years that give you some hope that there might be a better experience for weed control in the near future?
There'll be new premixes that come into the marketplace even in 2022. But in terms of new active ingredients, it's more likely we're looking at probably 3 years out before we really see something that we haven't seen much of here, at least not in North America. So not in the immediate future, but we do have hope maybe in about another 3 or 4 years we could have something.
Hey, at least that's a change from the past, I suppose.
That's a change from about the last 15 years, Todd, if we're counting. So
same subject matter, Aaron, but a different area, cultural practices, things like these seed smashers that we've seen that are available to mount to the back end of a combine that runs the chaff through a very tight area and smashes the seed, making it so that it can't emerge. I'm wondering how long it takes for weeds to adapt to cultural practices like this or some other practices. And I'm thinking, for instance, about the changing emergence of water hemp in the state of Illinois based on herbicide application timing.
That's a really good question, Todd. And the simple fact or the simple answer is that, yes, eventually they do adapt. The speed at which the adaptation takes place is really dependent on a whole host of factors. And it's kind of perilous, I guess, to try to put any numbers to it. But I've got an example of this. There was actually a paper published here back in the late 1960s or early 1970s, which made a prediction that Illinois farmers would never have to contend with giant ragweed as a weed problem in cornfields or soybean fields. Now, if you farm in the northern part of Illinois or certain river bottoms of Illinois, that probably caught your attention because you have giant ragweed populations with which you deal with annually. But the focus of that work was looking at the emergence pattern of giant ragweed. And essentially what they did is they made multiple collections around the state and did what's called a common garden experiment, where they planted these different accessions at one location. And they kept track of how long they emerged in the spring. And essentially they were done emerging by May 1st. Now, we said earlier that that work was done back in the late 1960s, but think about how we farmed in the late 1960s. You know, we weren't planting most of the corn and soybean crop by mid-April. We had plantings that were very common throughout the month of May. Well, and back in the late 60s and early 70s, we worked most of the ground before we planted it. So therefore, if you had a weed that had emerged, you worked the ground before you planted. That was the basis of that summary from that paper that was published so many years ago. Well, a few years back, that's experiment was repeated. So accessions or collections of giant ragweed were made across fields in Illinois, brought back for a common garden experiment. The difference this time around, though, was that the researchers also included accessions of giant ragweed that had been collected from areas that had never been farmed. So for example, a woodlot somewhere, maybe the corner of a cemetery somewhere. These populations had never been exposed to agricultural production practices. This has nothing to do with herbicide resistance, okay? And so when they repeated this experiment, what they found is that the giant ragweed collections or accessions that came from agricultural fields, now they had emergence by May 1st, like it always had, but they saw prolonged emergence. They saw emergence that continued throughout the month of June, even into July. But the few accessions that were collected from areas that had never been farmed, they came up and stopped at May 1st. So in other words, giant ragweed as a species over a period of 40, 50 years has simply adapted to how we farm these days. And you mentioned water hemp, another example of a species that is very adaptable to how we farm. And certainly one way that we have seen this evolutionary adaptability is in its evolution of many of the herbicides that were once previously effective for it.
And one final question. This one has to do with the mitigation things that producers might be able to do today. For instance, Aaron, you often, when you and I talk in an interview, we'll discuss the importance of cleaning a combine out before moving from one field to another. What kinds of things can producers do today that might be helpful for the future?
You know, I think one thing, Todd, right off the bat is just simply the recognition of the fact that seeds are going to move, whether it be by practices that farmers are doing, moving weed seeds through tillage equipment, through combines. That certainly is a very visible, easy way to see seed movement. But seeds are going to move in other ways. They're going to move in migrating waterfowl, for example. They're going to move by movement of water. So recognizing the fact that, again, their populations last year may not always be the same populations that they're going to contend with this year. You know, for example, if you had a scenario where in 2021, you had a herbicide that was very effective on your problem weed species. Well, what happens over the wintertime after harvest when we're not paying attention because we're doing other things and somehow this new seed has been deposited in the field? Maybe there's a flock of geese that fed in that field for several days and they deposited seeds from, you know, 2,000 miles from here. Well, now you've got the start of a new problem. And, you know, scouting is certainly a good effort before application, after application. If you see changes taking place, don't just assume that there was something wrong with the application, for example. This may be that change, evolutionary change taking place, and try to adjust your program as fast as possible and stay in front of these changes, because it's always easier to try to manage a problem before it actually happens than try to fix the problem after it happens.
That was University of Illinois Extension weed scientist Aaron Hager. He made his comments during a fall webinar on weed species and the potential problems that producers are facing next spring and in the future. You may find that webinar on the FarmDoc Daily website now, if you'd like, at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. Look in the webinar section under the archives and you'll find Weeds there with Aaron Hager. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Find us online at willag.org, willag.org. This has been our Challenges Ahead special. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media and University of Illinois Extension. Again, you may find our programming at willag.org to listen to anytime you'd like on demand. Just click and play right from the website. That website also has been refreshed. Hopefully you've visited. You'll find not only today's Closing Market Report and Commodity Week posted there, but also information from the Ag Economist, Crop Scientist, and others at the University of Illinois, and a way to listen to us as a podcast. If you scroll down the page, there are links to places like Stitcher and SoundCloud, NPR One, Apple Podcast, and Google Podcast, too. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.